Welcome to the Legal Aid New South Wales Criminal Law Division podcast. The Criminal Law Division of Legal Aid New South Wales acknowledges the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the traditional custodians of the land and waters. We acknowledge this podcast is recorded on Aboriginal land and pay our respect to elders past and present. We extend that respect to First Nations listeners joining us here today.
Welcome to the first edition of the Five Cases podcast. The Five Cases podcast will be a regular podcast that summarises five cases relevant to criminal lawyers in New South Wales on every topic from bail through to parole. My name is Paul Cody from the Public Defenders Chambers in Sydney.
And I'm Caitlin Akhtar of Forbes Chambers in Sydney. These case reviews are just meant as a brief update to assist practitioners to stay abreast of current case law. We won't be discussing any cases at great length. We're just trying to highlight a number of cases that might assist you to make your own inquiries of cases to assist your advocacy. They're not meant to be complete case summaries, and we encourage you to refer to the full judgment. There are links in the show notes to this episode.
In today's edition, published on the 26th of May 2023, we're going to be looking at cases dealing with the following topics.
I'll take us through a High Court case that considers what a break is in a break and enter, and a case on the application of Brown and Dunn in the Child Sexual Offence Evidence Scheme.
And I'll be looking at how intensive corrections orders are to be approached following the High Court's decision in Stanley. If you're still confused in the debate of moral culpability v. objective seriousness, we'll look at what the Court of Criminal Appeal has recently said about it. And I'd like to talk briefly about a 2022 Victorian County Court decision which is about to become relevant in New South Wales.
Our first case is BA and the King, 2023 HCA 14. This case determined that a person does not commit a break within the meaning of the offence of break and enter by entering premises to which they have a right to enter under a lease. In this case, the accused and the complainant were co-tenants on a leased residence. The accused attended the property and demanded to be let in. When he was refused entry by the complainant, he kicked in the door, damaging the doorframe, intimidated and assaulted his ex-partner. The High Court determined that the accused was guilty of malicious damage, intimidation and assault. That wasn't in dispute. However, the fact the accused was on the lease meant he had a lawful right of entry that meant he couldn't be guilty of the element of break necessary to establish the offence of break, enter and commit a serious indictable offence. The accused ex-partner, the complainant, did not alter the accused's right to entry by her refusal to consent to it. The essential reasoning is found in paragraph 42. The court found that for the offence of break, enter, and commit a serious indictable offence to be proven, the Crown must establish that an accused was a trespasser. That is, they had no lawful right of entry. In BA, the accused had a lawful right of entry, and therefore the element of break was not established. The accused was liable for his other offending behaviour, but not for the offence of break, enter, and commit a serious indictable offence. Our next case is PJ and the King, 2023, New South Wales CCA 105. PJ and the King considers, among other things, the rule in Brown and Dunn in the context of the cross-examination of children in trials that are conducted pursuant to the Child Sexual Offence Evidence Scheme. In short, the child complainant had been cross-examined to suggest that her complaint about the accused's behaviour had arisen from a suggestion from her brother. Following the completion of the complainant's evidence, an application was made to recall the complainant for further cross-examination so that it could be suggested to the complainant that it was her mother who had instigated the concoction of a false story. The provisions of the pilot scheme provided that the complainant could not be recalled except in particular specified circumstances. The judge refused the application by defence counsel. The case came before the Court of Criminal Appeal as an interlocutory appeal pursuant to Section 5F of the Criminal Appeal Act. The judgment first dealt with the question of whether the court had jurisdiction to hear the matter pursuant to that section, having regard to the limited nature of that appeal mechanism. That portion of the decision is not the focus of this summary. Despite refusing leave to appeal on this basis, the court went on to consider the merit of the appeal as against the possibility that the refusal of leave was wrong. At trial, the Crown did not oppose the recalling of the complainant and foreshadowed that if the complainant were not recalled, the Crown would oppose the accused suggesting to the jury that the complainant's mother had instigated the concoction of a false story, on the basis this has not been put to the complainant. On appeal, the Crown did not maintain this position. The Court of Criminal Appeal observed there are limitations on the application of the rule in Brown and Dunn with respect to the accused in criminal trials, citing the High Court's decision in Hoffa and the Queen. At paragraphs 61 and 117, the Court of Criminal Appeal made clear that the failure of counsel for the accused to put a matter to a witness would not prevent them from making the submission in closing. Over to you, Paul.
Thanks, Caitlin. The first decision that I want to talk about is Zheng and the King, spelt Z-H-E-N-G, and the citation is square brackets 2023 NSW CCA 64. This was a conviction and sentence appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeal, but I only want to focus on the sentence appeal as it sets out a very clear treatment of how to approach intensive corrections orders in circumstances of domestic violence offences and, following the recent High Court authority of Stanley, what it means to prioritise community safety. The applicant was a woman married to the complainant. The allegation was that she stabbed the complainant. She was convicted of wounding, being reckless as to causing actual bodily harm, contrary to section 35(4) of the Crimes Act, after unsuccessfully raising self-defence. She was originally sentenced to prison for 2 years and 6 months, with a non-parole period of 10 months. At appeal, however, the court was convinced that the sentence imposed was manifestly excessive and then engaged in the process of re-sentence from paragraph 267. Following the decision in Stanley, we now know that the court has to follow the following process. First, to assess whether the person is to be sentenced to a term of imprisonment. Second, if so, to assess for how long. And three, only then can the court consider whether an intensive corrections order is to be imposed. The court, from paragraph 281, gave a very useful summary of the principles arising from Stanley, and I'll try and summarise them. There are 5 points. First, the power to make an intensive corrections order requires an evaluative exercise that treats community safety as the paramount consideration, with the benefit of an assessment mandated by section 66(2) of the Sentencing Act. So the issue is not merely about the offender's risk of reoffending, but the narrower risk of reoffending in a manner that may affect community safety. Second, section 66(2) is premised upon the view that an offender's risk of reoffending may be different depending upon how their sentence of imprisonment is served. And this implicitly rejects any assumption that full-time detention of the offender will most effectively promote community safety. Third, the nature and content of the conditions that might be imposed by an intensive corrections order will be important in measuring the risk of reoffending. Fourth, the consideration of community safety required by section 66(2) of the Sentencing Act is to be undertaken in a forward-looking manner, having regard to the offender's risk of reoffending. And fifth, while community safety is not the sole consideration in the decision to make or to refuse an ICO, it will usually have a decisive effect unless the evidence is inconclusive. But in this case, the court also had to grapple with the additional prohibition on intensive corrections orders in matters of domestic violence, which is contained in section 4B of the Sentencing Act. In the process of resentencing, the court looked at this issue of community safety as not simply being achieved by jailing someone, and in fact deciding that that may have the opposite effect, decreasing community safety. The court used this forward-looking approach, which was approved of in Stanley, to evaluate community safety as the paramount concern, finding the risk of reoffending in a manner that might affect community safety would be better reduced by an intensive corrections order in this case, more so than full-time imprisonment. So it's a clear and useful case for how to apply the High Court's decision Stanley, with the additional complication of the domestic violence prohibitions contained in section 4B. The second decision I'd like to look at is also a sentence appeal, and that's Lawrence and the King, 2023, NSW CCA 110. In this case, the applicant was sentenced for a number of domestic violence offences, and the relevant appeal ground for today was a complaint that the sentencing judge erred in her assessment of objective seriousness of the offending without referring to the applicant's moral culpability and mental health conditions and a deprived background. And the reason I want to highlight this case is that this is still an area that can trap practitioners in difficult arguments with the bench, especially in the local and district court where oral advocacy is perhaps relied upon more so than written advocacy. And to that end, Lawrence is a case which sets out the clear principles that apply. The court held at paragraph 79 that a sentencing judge is to consider a person's moral culpability separately from the objective gravity of the offences. So in this case, his deprived background and mental health difficulties were features that affected the weight to be given to consideration of moral blameworthiness and general deterrence, but they were not relevant to an assessment of the gravity offences committed over a prolonged period. So there will be times where a causally related mental impairment may reduce the objective seriousness of an offence, but there's no principle of law that states that a related impairment must reduce objective gravity. To that end, both the court in Lawrence and coincidentally Caitlin and I would like to refer people to the case of DS and DM and the Queen, 2022, NSW CCA 156. This was a decision of the Chief Judge at Common Law and Justices Adam and Kavanagh. And this case sets out a very comprehensive and clear approach to the differences between assessments of moral culpability and objective seriousness. Both cases of Lawrence and DS and DM assist with differentiating between those two difficult concepts. The final case that I'd like to bring to people's attention is the Victorian decision of the DPP and Rotumah, spelled Rotumah, square brackets 2022 VCC 1532. And Rotumah is the first decision that Caitlin and I can find omitting what are called Aboriginal Community Justice Reports. These reports in Victoria are modelled on GLADGIE reports, which are community written reports. Just by way of background, in 1996, the Canadian government amended sentencing laws to require judges to look at all reasonable options available other than jail when sentencing all individuals, but particularly Indigenous persons. In the case of GLADUE, spelt G-L-A-D-U-E, the court considered that this amendment to the sentencing law was intended as a remedy to the overrepresentation of First Nations people, and what flowed from it was the need to find a new way of determining a suitable sentence for First Nations people. So GLADUE reports in Canada became an important tool in providing the judiciary with information about the background and circumstances of First Nations peoples in order for a judge to properly consider the circumstances of the individual before them for the purposes of crafting a suitable sentence. In the Australian context, in 2017, the Australian Law Reform Commission recommended that state and territory governments, in partnership with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations, should develop and implement schemes that would facilitate the preparation of what they called Indigenous Experience Reports. In Victoria, these are now called Aboriginal Community Justice Reports. And in the case of Rotumah, the court admitted the Aboriginal Community Justice Report to provide background to the offender's life and experience. Paragraph 39, the court stated that Aboriginal Community Justice Reports provide a wider lens that brings perspective on the collective experiences of the individual, family and community, as well as a relevant history of colonisation and its impacts, as well as an outline of contemporary interventions, circumstances, policies and laws that have impacted Aboriginal people and communities. Caitlin, are we going to expect Aboriginal Community Justice Reports in New South Wales courts anytime soon?
Yes, I think so, Paul. Deadly Connections is the organisation who are currently staffing positions in order to produce Community Justice Reports in New South Wales. We expect to start seeing these reports coming into District Court and Supreme Court proceedings, hopefully by the end of this year. Keep your eyes open for them, and hopefully that Victorian decision can be used to at least ease judicial concerns about admissibility. When we have confirmation that project is up and running, we'll provide more information.
That's all we have time for today. We hope this podcast has been of assistance to you in your day-to-day practice. Please reach out if you come across decisions that you think will assist you and other practitioners. And otherwise, we'll see you the next podcast in 2 months.
Bye.